You're no good. You're so vain. I love rock and roll. The tide is high. Brass in pocket. What's love got to do with it? Stop dragging my heart around. Hit me with your best shot. Barracuda. Ah, the great women who gave us these songs are featured on today's Promotion Man podcast. So let's get this party started because it's ladies' night.
Today's episode is going to be about women and rock. Because if you really look at the influence of some of the women we're about to talk about in rock and roll music, it's huge.
And I have a feeling that after we do this podcast, we're going to get some comments from listeners going like, "But yeah, but what about her? Or what about her?" So there may be a little cleanup on aisle two in the upcoming weeks on some we may have not overlooked, but just didn't think about.
You know? I think you're right. And speaking of cleanup on aisle two, can we run Ava, please?
Yeah, she's been a little lonely. We haven't had her.
All right, so let's run her.
Cleanup on aisle two.
There you go, little Ava.
Excellent. All right. What happened is I think you went to Dallas for some sort of radio something something.
Yep.
Left me here alone.
All alone in the ATX.
So I went to see the Linda Ronstadt movie, which is called The Sound of My Voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a great movie.
Yeah.
It's an art movie, so it's not going to be a blockbuster by any means. And it is a documentary. But she actually did the narrating of it, which I think was really pretty poignant.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happened is once they started to get into her and her career, it was astonishing that she sold 100 million records.
Wow.
In her career.
I didn't realize it was that many.
I mean, 100 million, and she really kind of dominated the 70s.
Yeah.
So as we were talking in older podcasts about me being a part of the WEA group, which stood for Warner Brothers, Elektra, Asylum, and then Atlantic Records.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Elektra, Asylum really had that California sound kind
right.
of harnessed. And so there were so many things I learned in this movie. For example, her first band was a band called Stone Pony.
Right.
And clearly, the powers that be in the music business, especially back then, had a lot of influence on a career. And they said, listen, lose the band. We want to focus on you as a solo artist. And they talked about how the Troubadour on Sunset was a place where they had like open mic nights.
Yeah.
And that was a huge place for a lot of up-and-comers to get in front of their peers and lay out some of their new stuff and see how it was received. And she ran into J.D. Souther, who was always kind of in the background in a lot of different pretty big bands. He had helped her put a band together. So he said, listen, I've got a couple of great guys with great background vocal, you know, so I want to bring in a guy named Glenn Frey, and I want to bring in another guy named Don Henley.
Wow.
And so Don Henley was her drummer, and Glenn Frey was one of the guitar players.
Right.
And when they had their station wagon tour, Don and Glenn had to split a room. So all of a sudden, they're playing each other's songs that they had been working on or written.
Right.
And then they started singing together, and they said to each other, you know, let's put a band together.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you have this band called the Eagles.
Isn't that great how that came out? But I mean, you're so right. J.D. Souther, if you really go back and you want to, you know, go through your old vinyl or something where you actually can still see the songwriting credits, his name is attached to so many artists that were during that time, for sure.
Very much so. And that's why it was really kind of a cool flick, because all of a sudden it brought in David Geffen,
yeah,
who started Asylum Records. And there's another movie out called Echo in the Canyon.
Yeah.
So after I saw this one, The Sound of My Voice by Linda Ronstadt, I came home and started cruising Amazon and found this, Echo in the Canyon. So I bought it.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about it was it laid parallel to Linda and her story, because in California and that whole California sound, there was... you know, something clearly going on.
Oh, yeah.
And so Jacob Dylan, Bob Dylan's son, who I actually worked with because he had a band called Wildflowers.
Wallflowers.
Yes.
Clean up on aisle two.
So Wallflowers was on Virgin Records. They did their debut album.
Yeah.
We actually went to New York. They had a meeting and they wanted all the Virgin reps in New York City. And part of the deal was they wanted us to come. I think it was Old Town Theater. They wanted us to see the Wallflowers play live. That album that we had on Virgin was stiffed horribly. Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if we sold 100,000 copies.
Wow.
So for whatever reason, they were dropped from the label, and Interscope picked them up.
And then they exploded.
Absolutely. What was
One Headlight.
One Headlight.
Yeah.
It was a massive song.
Huge song. Still gets played.
And Dylan's got this, Jacob Dylan's got this interesting kind of composure about him. He's kind of easygoing and really kind of got a different groove. His movie is Echo in the Canyon is about Laurel Canyon and all the stuff going on there. Mm-hmm. So David Geffen was signing bands like Joni Mitchell, the Eagles,
right?
You know, because once Don and Glenn decided to start a band, David had already signed Linda Ronstadt. So, you know, that's how a lot of this stuff spurred off other bands.
And the thing about it was, is, you know, we've talked a little bit in previous episodes about some artists that were predominantly FM album rock artists. And then there was others who was still the AM or the pop radio. And Linda, I guess, started probably as the FM rock thing when she was with Stone Ponies, but then she just kind of progressed over into the pop side. I mean, she had a ton of hits.
Ton of hits. And actually, even the Eagles, when they came out with their first album called Desperado, it really wasn't that well received in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And she loved that song, the lead track. So she recorded it and made it a massive hit.
Right.
Which, you know, carried them on because obviously the money they get from not only the royalties, but the fact that all of a sudden she kind of put them on the map as really proficient songwriters as well.
The one that really got it for me that I became a huge fan was You're No Good. I mean, that song to me just like, I was like, man, that is one pissed off chick, man, and she is going to put it out there in song.
When I started looking at her stuff.
Yeah.
You're No Good, which went on to be her number one song. It's So Easy, Blue Bayou, Different Drum. She did a duet with Aaron Neville called I Don't Know Much,
right?
Which just absolutely was this amazing ballad. And she won two Grammys. They both won two Grammys for that song.
And a funny thing about You're No Good, since we've talked about Van Halen so much, you know, they actually cover You're No Good.
Yeah, they actually do. They actually do. And Linda was not a songwriter.
Oh, really?
So she never really wrote any of her songs, not that I'm aware of, but she would take these songs that really kind of resonated with her. But during this time, you know, there were some amazingly powerful women. Bonnie Raitt was really a powerful singer in her own right. And
but really another one that didn't really get her full due while she was with Warner Brothers. It was after she left that she really kind of went to the next level. Right?
Yeah, when she got signed to Capitol, her career really took off.
Yeah.
And on Warner Brothers, we had a girl named Emmylou Harris.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Emmy was more of a country girl.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a country division. And I remember meeting her at a sound check, you know, and sound checks were really kind of odd because you're always in this theater, it's empty, there's no one there, and they're all, you know, working through everything to make sure that prior to the show, everything's, all the levels are there. And her road manager kind of looked at me and said, "Where's her flowers?" And I was like, oops.
Wow.
I didn't even really think about the fact that she was a woman.
Yeah.
And I should probably be, you know, coming to see her bearing flowers. And I felt so bad that when I came back for the show, I had a dozen roses for her. And honestly, from that point forward, whenever I had a female artist that I was going to go see, I always made sure I had flowers.
So note to you, ladies who really like the sound of Fred's voice on your first date, expect flowers from him.
Yes,
so
of course.
He's that kind of guy.
And I'll actually put them together because I'm kind of good at that.
And you can thank Linda Ronstadt.
Yeah. So David Geffen's signing every Southern California band that's coming out of Topanga and, is it Topanga?
Topanga, yes.
And Laurel Canyon. And Jackson Browne was one of those people. Carly Simon was another. And actually Tom Waits, who had this whole nother groove about him. I mean, I remember my Elektra rep told me this story about how he had to pick up Tom from the airport. Tom wanted to go straight to the ghetto of Detroit and find the most flea bag hotel to stay in because that's what he wanted. He didn't want a Hilton or whatever. He wanted like some off-brand down in the ghetto kind of a...
But one thing that's very funny about Tom Waits, no matter how quirky you may think he is, there's still someone that wants to pay tribute. In fact, I have a couple of coworkers who do all Tom Waits songs on their side time. And their little the shows are called Tom Waits for No One.
Oh, that's awesome.
So.
Well, and for the listeners, he wrote Old 55, which the Eagles recorded and made a huge hit. So during this time, not only did I get a chance to work with Bonnie Raitt and Emmylou Harris, Linda Ronstadt and those two hung out a lot. Mm-hmm. They were on a lot of Little Feat shows, a lot of Little Feat albums, singing background.
Yeah.
They got together a lot on the side and really hung out with each other quite a bit and became real friends in a rock and roll male-dominated industry.
Well, one thing about this time as well, again, I had not really immersed myself into FM album-oriented rock radio per se. I was a pop guy, listened to the top 40 radio stations as a kid. Linda was there. And another one is Carly Simon. I mean, You're So Vain seemed like it was on the radio for 2 years, you know, in a current rotation. That song was so huge. And Carly Simon is another amazing, you know, singer, songwriter, performer, and just everything about her. She was the total package.
No question. And she actually took Michael McDonald's You Belong to Me.
Yeah, that's right.
And made it a huge hit herself. And then, of course, everyone knows that her and James Taylor were married.
Right.
James was actually on Warner Brothers and actually left us for Columbia. And we were like shocked.
Right.
Because he really fit our label so well. And
why do you think he left?
You know, it's probably money. It was probably a really lucrative contract offer. But I also had a chance to work with, obviously, Stevie Nicks because she was, with Fleetwood Mac. And Maria Muldaur was one of our artists that we had when I first entered.
Wait a minute. Is this Midnight at the Oasis,
yeah,
girl?
Yeah.
Wow. This is an honest, true story. My daughter was playing some obscure artist, as she likes to play me some really good deep stuff she finds on Spotify. And I said, this song reminds me of something. I want to play it for you. Yesterday, as we were driving home, I played Midnight at the Oasis for my daughter, and she loved it. She was playing it at home later on that evening for my wife and her sister. So that is really weird how that worked out that you brought her up today.
And, you know, that was a great song. It was a hit. It stayed on the charts for quite a while.
And she asked me about her. I said, I don't really know anything about her except I love this song as a kid. And it was on the radio forever, and she was a one-hit wonder, and I never heard anything else from her.
Yeah, and just like kind of Nicolette Larson, she had a similar kind of groove where she had really curly, flowing hair. She was very earthy, hippie-ish, and I never had a chance to actually meet her, but I did. I worked the tail end of one of her albums, meaning when I joined the company, it had already been released and coming down the chart. But another female artist that I had that was intense was Chrissy Hyde of The Pretenders.
Now, I love The Pretenders. I've never met Chrissy, so I'm only speculating here, but she seems like one tough cookie to probably work with, if I'm right.
You're just being so politically correct here. Oh my gosh. So here's the skinny on Pretenders. There are certain bands that every record promotion person that hears this podcast is going to say, man, this band, you know, was the one I really championed because, you know, that's what a promotion person's job was.
Right.
You grab onto a song and you champion it. And I thought the debut album of The Pretenders was just the most magnificent debut album. I mean, Tattooed Love Boys is just a in-your-face rock and roll. You know, but we came out with Stop Your Sobbing. And I didn't even know we were going to go into Pretenders deeply, so I don't have a real script written. But off the cuff, I can tell you that I was the one that really started to get the early airplay. And I really believed in Brass and Pocket was our lead track in the very beginning. But Chrissy had had this rough, tumble, edgy kind of a vibe about her.
Yeah.
And the only interaction I ever really had with her was once I was in Houston at a, it was a venue that maybe had 2,000 seats. It was really a pretty cool place to see them.
Mm-hmm.
I always loved to watch the sound checks if I had the time. She stopped and said, "Who are you?"
She didn't want you in there.
She didn't, and I was just, you know, I wasn't making any noise. I wasn't doing anything. You had some women in rock that you...
Yeah, I mean, I'll start right from the beginning. I mean, Linda Ronstadt, you know, I was still, you know, a young teenager, maybe 13 when she really started coming on the scene. So... but I have to say, as I'm getting into high school, about to head into college, the two females that really, really stuck with me, first of all, was Joan Jett. And second of all, was Deborah Harry of Blondie. I mean, these are the two that really resonated with me. And I always like to tell this story. Billboard magazine, you know, when they have their Hot 100, there was a magazine advertisement for Joan Jett's tour. She was playing these small clubs, maybe 100 people. And it said, "Do you love rock and roll?" It's a full-page ad promoting the I Love Rock and Roll album. And I just loved that ad, so I cut it out. And then I kept going like, this song is going to be number one. It's going to be number one. It's going to be number one. It finally went to number one, and I was in college at the time when it happened, and I was working in this media department where we could laminate different things. So I took the ad, the Joan Jett ad, and laid it on top of the Billboard Hot 100 where she had that number one song.
But so, and I'm glad you brought her up because here's another girl that was very edgy.
Yeah.
You know, the Runaways were a phenomenal band. And she was a great leader of that band. And Deborah Harry was a completely different 360 in her approach, in her look, in her vibe, much more sophisticated, I suppose, much more arty.
I thought she was just dynamic and sexy. I just thought she was just, she was a sex goddess to me. And even though she wasn't really putting it out there, she just can't really explain it.
She was beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, she was absolutely beautiful. And Patti Smith was another one that she ended up marrying one of the members of the MC5. Iggy and the Stooges,
right.
Fred Sonic Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And so she spent a lot of time in Detroit because of Iggy and the Stooges. She was another one. If you dig deeper into the 60s, Grace Slick was extremely beautiful, had a phenomenal voice, and led not only Jefferson Airplane, but Jefferson Starship to some pretty high heights because she was just dynamic. She was great to watch. And then, of course, everyone knows about how important Janis Joplin was to Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Right.
Because she was like no other.
There's one other female artist.
Was it like Josh Stone or what's her name?
Josh Stone was definitely had that powerful voice. Good call on that one. The only other one I would say in the modern day era, rock female vocalist, is Lizzie Hale of the band Hailstorm. I mean, she just sings with that emotion and just, you know, she really works her voice where she can just go all night long and it never gets weak. She just has that power behind her the same way that Janis did.
You know what I just remembered? You really loved this girl named Poe.
Oh, yes, yes.
And she had a kind of an intrigue. I mean, tell everybody what you thought of her.
I guess the only thing I could compare to might be a Debbie Harry because she did come at it from an artsy standpoint.
She was kind of punky.
She was kind of punky, but she had this really great charisma about her. And the first time I heard this song, Angry Johnny, I was just like, this song is a hit. We started playing at the radio station. And we got her in for a Christmas show the first year we had launched this new radio station in Austin. And as they were driving from the airport to the radio station for an interview with me, was the first time they'd ever heard their song on the radio. And they were
this is
so amazing. Just they were in there high-fiving in the car and everything. It's like, this is so cool to finally hear our song on the radio. You know,
what? That's got to be the most amazing thing for any band. And I've heard a lot of people you know, tell that story.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when U2 told me when they first heard I Will Follow on the radio, you know, and it's like huge for a band to hear their own song.
Right. You know, and one other thing about females, not only to make this secular and all about rock, but, you know, going back to Detroit, Motown, think about how many dynamic females that were just leading the way, the Diana Rosses of the world, and a lot of the girl groups that...
Mary Wells, Aretha Franklin.
Right.
But, you know, when you brought that up, we were lucky to have two interviews, one with Wayne Kramer of MC5 and one with Alice Cooper, and they have a project out called Breadcrumbs. It's an EP, and the lead track's called Detroit City 2020.
Love that song.
Honestly, it's...
I want it to be our theme song.
I want it to be our... I mean, it's just rocks, but... Alice, who's doing the lead vocals, is mentioning every single Detroit band he can put in this song.
Yeah.
And he says Susie Quattro.
Yeah, I caught that.
And see, Susie, she was another kind of like one of these pre-punk rocker ones, you know, always wore black leather pants and a fluffy white blouse. And she was an attractive brunette, but she had this raw power about her that, was undeniable, and though she never went really far.
Never really blew up. The only thing that I even knew about Susie Quattro, and I thought that she was only an actress because she was on Happy Days. I think she was either a friend of Fonzie or Fonzie's girlfriend or something.
Should have been Fonzie's girlfriend.
Maybe it was his girlfriend.
Should have been.
I might have to do some cleanup on aisle two on that one, but she did. She was did lots of appearances there on Happy Days back in the 70s.
Yeah, and so then in my career with Virgin Records, mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to be with some pretty big women, Tina Turner.
Oh, yeah.
And I have to tell you that Tina was so naturally beautiful.
Right.
Like, her photographs that you see of her are really, they replicate her in natural life because she's got these high cheekbones and she's just a beautiful woman. But she's got this power and this certain something about her and her live shows. Man, when I was with her at Virgin, it was What's Love Got to Do with It? And that tour, man, I don't know if she was ever, that to me felt like the pinnacle of her tour. Of her career, because right. She was just delivering the goods. And then we had Janet Jackson, who at that point at Virgin Records, you know, when I read Richard Branson's book called Losing My Virginity, it was a really inspiring book because he was talking about business and how to be a businessman and why everybody says, look, if you're an expert in a field, that's where you need to stay and do your thing.
Right.
And he was like, well, what if you look at somebody else and go, I could do that better, you know, and that's against all the norms of just be the best at in what you do.
Right.
And I was starting a real estate firm, so I really wanted my company to be different and a cutting edge. And so that book was kind of poignant for me to read. But while I'm reading it, what I didn't realize is that he was banking the whole company on Janet's career.
Wow.
And he was literally playing poker, where he was putting all the chips in the center of the table, and he was borrowing and leveraging and things I had no idea was going on when we were in the field.
Yeah.
But when we signed Janet and we released that record, I think that was kind of the pinnacle of her career. I'm trying to think of the Janet album.
Oh, you mean Call Me Mr. Myers If You're Nasty?
No, because Nasty
Control was the album.
Yeah, Control, that was all on A&M Records.
Oh, that was A&M, my bad.
Yeah. And here,
Rhythm Nation, were you Rhythm Nation?
No, that was A&M too.
My bad.
And see, and here's the deal.
Well, I'm cleaning up all aisle two big
and
time
I didn't
today.
Write any of this Janet stuff down because I didn't think I was going to go down this rabbit hole.
Right.
And maybe we shouldn't because maybe Janet and Tina deserve their own episode. But I had a chance to work with them. And then Virgin had actually signed Joan Baez.
Okay.
Which is really kind of interesting because she was such a poster child for the 60s and such a champion of Bob Dylan. Mm-hmm. They were romantically involved. They were the very beginning of that folky music.
Right.
And when she was on tour and came to Austin, unlike Tom Waits wanting to be in the seedy hotel, she wanted a bed and breakfast. Right. I mean, she was not about the Four Seasons or anything like that. Nice. She was like, you know, and so I found her this really cute little bed and breakfast in Hyde Park.
Oh my
and
gosh.
She couldn't have been happier.
Oh, that's the perfect place for her. You know, you did touch on Stevie Nicks, and I have to say, another one in my top five. I mentioned Joan Jett, I mentioned Deborah Harry, but Stevie Nicks, and these were all women that I had posters on my wall in my dorm in college. But Stevie Nicks had already come off this really successful career as part of a group, and then all of a sudden, she's on Modern Records, which is the same label that Poe was on that we mentioned a little earlier as well. But she came out guns a-blazing, man, and you know, she really, I think, put herself... Being a strong front woman's like, I can carry myself as a solo artist. So Stevie Nicks was another one that I still, you know, whether she stops touring with Fleetwood Mac forever and comes back just does her solo stuff, I'd be all in.
And for all the right reasons. You know, these women that we're talking about, each and every one of them individually, you know, were carrying a weight of kind of being in a man's world.
Yeah.
Which is why, like, you know, in the movie Sound of My Voice with Linda Ronstadt, she had said, you know, that she really palled up with Bonnie Raitt and Emmy Lou Harris because she needed that camaraderie from them. And they were all so strong in their own way. Like, Emmy Lou's voice is so velvety and so rich.
Right.
You know, but I have a story about Bonnie Raitt that's kind of important to me is, you know, I was transferring from Detroit to Houston. So I'm with her in Houston at a sound check, and we're at the time I smoked cigarettes. So her and I were smoking cigarette in like the stairwell, and we were bullshitting. And I told her I was really excited that I, had just got my house in Houston. And she said, "Well, what's your territory?" And I said, "Well, I've got Austin, San Antonio, Beaumont, Corpus." She goes, "Austin is amazing."
Really?
She said, "You are going to love that town." She says, "Here's my advice. When you check into the Driscoll Hotel, which is where you need to stay, just take your rental car and go west. Take 6th Street and just keep going."
Wow.
She says, "Because if you don't leave the downtown area, you're not going to realize that it's a part of this Texas Hill Country."
Yeah.
Which is this gorgeous rolling hills. And then the river, which everyone calls Lake Austin here, which is not a lake, it's a river.
Right.
You know, so I actually discovered Mount Bonnell on my own because I ended up parking there and seeing these steps. And yeah. I thought, well, let's go check it out.
Wow.
You know, and at the time, Bonnie was like, she's wearing these tight jeans and she's got this flowing red hair and she's just beautiful woman.
Yeah.
And she was so animated about my visit to Austin. And every time she plays here, she goes water skiing. And she has, you know, the time of her life because she knows this town very, very well.
Right.
So, you know, I think it was kind of fun that we highlighted some of these women in rock.
And again, as I said at the beginning of the show today, I'm sure there's probably some that we'll think about after we stop recording. It's like, oh, I should have brought her up. But, I mean, I really think I've touched on some that really, really stood out to me. And you know, as you said, it was definitely tough for women back then in a male-dominated format, especially in the rock genre. And I think that still kind of carries on today a little bit. I mean, back to mentioning Lizzie Hale, she was very adamant about touring with all female-led tours there. She actually got with Lita Ford, who, of course, was with Joan Jett and the Runaways.
Right.
And then a few up-and-coming new rock artists. I mean, it'd be like three or four bands, but all led by women. And I think she's kind of blazing the trail for that. So I just want to give her some props out there today, too.
Yeah, and the next podcast we're going to record, I go back to my tours, and my tours have Devo and the B-52s.
Yeah.
And the women in B-52s. Another women who really made the B-52s sound,
yeah,
you know, if you will. So I've got to kind of get a shout out to them, too, because what an exciting band. Now, I wasn't with Warner Brothers when they did Love Shack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was the Rock Lobster guy.
That's okay. Two different eras, but that's still totally good.
Yeah, Rock Lobster was the song that I worked to radio, and radio's like, what? What is this?
I can imagine at the time when it was occurring, it would be hard. But man, when I listen to that song now, you just can't help but be happy and just want to drink and just have fun. You know, I love that song.
Yeah, and so while we've been talking about the women in rock, or what this particular episode is called, We got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame list for 2020.
Yes, and I'm very excited that one of my heroes from my college days, I had her plastered all over my dorm wall. I was in love with this woman. She had short hair. She kind of had her own style. She had these vocals that just kicked ass. I mean, you know, hit me with your best shot.
Oh,
come
right on.
Pat Benatar, man.
Nice job, buddy.
She is awesome.
She is awesome.
I sure hope she gets into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame first time. I really do, man.
And you know what? Talk
damn
about
it, she's still married to that Neil Giraldo guy. I swear, I just don't have a chance in hell. But
which is kind of cool that they've navigated life as a married couple all this time.
And now she, when they tour, it's Pat Benatar with Neil Giraldo. They're in the same headlining there. It's not just Pat. So she's in love with her man. She loves him, and he's been great for her career, and she's been great for his. And God bless her, and I hope she goes into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She definitely belongs on this podcast.
So on the list of 2020 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominees is also Whitney Houston.
Yes.
Which, you know, obviously she had a tragic life, but up until that, she had a voice like no one else.
Right.
Like just no one else.
Yeah. I mean, and everyone always is conflicted when they say, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because people don't consider Whitney Houston rock, nor ABBA or Bee Gees or some of these, but they've had their influence. And I think, you know, maybe in another podcast, we'll just talk about some of these lesser known bands that maybe didn't have these gigantic hits, but still just what their influence was, they deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I agree. Now, also, the third and last one is Chaka Khan. Will you do your Chaka?
Chaka Khan.
Yeah.
Chaka Khan.
And in this particular...
Chaka Khan, let me rock it, Chaka Khan.
See, I'm sorry that I spawned that whole thing. Rufus featuring Chaka Khan is actually who's up for the nomination.
Right.
But I had a chance to work with Chaka Khan. And I'm in the back of a limo with her. And I said to her, I says, Chaka, you know, I'm a fairly good drummer. You know, if you want to go ahead and just tell that guy you got right now to, you know, go take a vacation.
Yeah.
I could fill in right now and we could get rolling. And she looked at me and goes, you're kind of jazzy. She was talking about my hair. She goes, you're kind of jazzy looking. And she kind of avoided the whole thing. And so I gave up my whole pitch because I never was able to replace Alex Van Halen one night. That never happened for me.
Right.
And so this was my R&B. I tried to get into Chaka Khan's band. That didn't work either.
Let me tell you something. Rufus, I think those songs were so funky, man. I mean, you know, they could be considered funk records instead of R&B almost. Because Rufus with Chaka Khan just moves you, man.
There's some
great singles they had.
Yeah, you're right. And we should have probably brought that up when we were talking about P-Funk and Funkadelics.
That's right, right. And then, of course, we can't leave out, you know, the Great Northwest and the Sisters. Barracuda, a song that has never left the radio either from the first day it was ever played. I mean, I think I play it every day on my radio station. But what a great song in their library.
So here's my story. I'm 20. I'm working in this record warehouse in the inner city of Detroit. And major labels had their own distribution. So if you were a smaller label, then you would have to rely on these other warehouse all around the country to not only take your albums in, but then ship them back out to the retail stores across the country. So in this particular warehouse I was working, it was called Arc JK Handelman's. And this is when Corvettes, I think, turned into Kmart.
Oh, wow.
And this is before Target. So all these department stores, you know, they carried all these items, clothing and whatnot. So they had to get their records from these warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember this warehouse, Arc JK, was distributing Motown because Motown was independent. United Artists, which had War, which I loved.
Yeah.
I loved the band War.
Yeah.
They had ELO, Electric Light Orchestra, which I love them.
Mm-hmm.
They had the only Beatles album because it was considered a soundtrack to Hard Day's Night.
Right.
And it was on United Artists. But then they had this little baby label out of Canada, of all places, called Mushroom Records.
I remember Mushroom, yes.
And all of a sudden, there's this album called Dreamboat Annie. And it's these two really attractive sisters. One is as brunette as you can get, and one is as blonde as you can get.
Right.
And one has these vocals that are just ridiculous. I mean, they're just off the charts, strong and powerful and distinctive. And then the other one is a really accomplished guitar player.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she wasn't just a filler. She could hold her own.
She was part of the band for sure.
So,
and she could do that little kick. I used to love that little kick she used to do. Exactly. Man, that was awesome.
I know what you're talking
about. A little
about.
Kick up higher than the microphone, man. It was awesome.
All right, so you people all around the world listening to this podcast, we love you, and you know it. But if we left off somebody you really dig, we're sorry.
Yes.
Because, you know, how deep can we get? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I'm sure there's definitely some that we'll even probably think about. It's like, oh, man, we should have brought them up. But I think we had a great list today. I mean, some of the women in rock, this was a good podcast today. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did, too. Thanks again.
Share it.
We're grassroots until we go mega big.
So give us your 5-star reviews. Go to promotion-man.com. Tell all your friends about it on Instagram, social media, Twitter, wherever it is you go, Facebook. Please please do that. And again, give us those 5-star reviews so we can rise to the top and be easily found by all your friends as well. I've enjoyed today. We've definitely covered a lot of the great women, not only in rock, but in soul and pop. And, you know, I think it's been a good show today.
Spice Girls.
That's a whole podcast in its own right there.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.